You're listening to Everything Horses and More podcast with me, your host, Caroline Best. I am the founder of my Dow Horsemanship Method, a pioneer in horse training and development, and a true advocate of the horse. I bring an intuitive and educated eye, along with an experienced and intelligent perspective to understanding both horse and human nature and behavior. My experience and skill sets are the cornerstone to my worldwide success in training methodology. My experience with horses as intelligent, sentient beings is what inspired me to create my highly acclaimed and proven training method, Consensual Partnership Training for Horses and Humans, a model I pioneered in 2008. Consensual Partnership Training provides a comprehensive and impressive curriculum, teaching horse owners how to fully develop their horses using a holistic, empathetic, and natural process. My training system teaches you how to achieve true partnership with horses and without the use of pain, excessive pressure, dominance, force, or coercion. In addition to being a world-class trainer for both horses and people, I'm an artist, author, entrepreneur, speaker, radio show host, licensed working equitation trainer, and riding foundation specialist. I offer one of the largest and most comprehensive online educational platforms, the Dow of Horsemanship, where I host a variety of courses produced and personally taught by me and my amazing schoolmasters. In addition to sharing what I know in my in-person training and online courses, I invite special guests and students each month to my radio show, Everything Horses and More podcast. This platform allows us to engage with all of you and share our very personal and transformational journey with horses. I invite you to listen in and hope you find something that helps inspire you to reach your personal goals and aspirations with your horse. Thank you, and may you always be one with horses. Welcome back, everybody. You know who I am, Caroline Best, the founder of Dow Horsemanship and your host to Everything Horses and More podcast. And today we've got Lydia back, our co-host, our beautiful co-host. Yay. And we have a wonderful guest speaker, Susan Eoff. Is that how we pronounce your last name?
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Welcome, Susan. I'm so excited to do this podcast. I love your story and your life experience. So I'm going to start out talking about giving a bio on Susan before I let you take the stage, my dear. But I just want to read a little bit to introduce people more to who you are, because your life is so fascinating. And then we'll dive in deep to our topic today. My quest in India changed my life as a professional dressage trainer. So this is going to be juicy. I love it. I love it. Welcome. Okay. So Susan's life is both fascinating and riveting. Her journey as a professional horse trainer, competitive ballroom dancer, and world traveler has led her to create an amazing body of work that we're going to talk about later. Here's an excerpt from Susan that's sure to titillate you. This is from Susan. I kept studying dressage because I wanted to get to the essence of true riding and partnership. 20 years of ballroom dancing, more searching for the essence of true partnership. I wanted to improve my feel for riding and find a way to help students find the feel as well. In 2011, I packed up a successful dressage business in Southern California and went looking for deeper answers for myself and humanity. It took me through South Africa and then landed in India. After a number of years in India and support to return to the Western world, I found myself back in the horse world. Integrating dressage, dance, and a spiritual inquiry has led to developing her own program called Awakened Horsemanship. Awakened Horsemanship is based on 11 simple experiences of one's mind, body, and soul. The program is created for riders as a dismounted workshop, meaning no riding, to heighten the ability to know oneself and transmit that clarity through the riding. The experiences apply directly to the horse as well. So currently, Susan's journey led her to Kentucky, where she bought a farm, and it's called Horse Woods Haven. She's created an environment harmonizing the land, the woods, and the horses. It has provided a profound opening to understanding the herd as an observer, steward, and member. The next step is offering online and farm workshops. The land stewarding has deepened my partnership with the earth. And I know Lydia, coming from 30 years or a life career in owning and operating your own nursery, and you in the land, Lydia. So you two have so much in common. Lydia has a lot of knowledge, tremendous knowledge, and it's wonderful when she starts talking about her experiences working the land. Okay, I've got one more thing I want to read, Susan, and then I'm going to turn it over to you.
And you have to tell me what you're going to want me to say, because you have
right. Yes, yes, I've got questions. Oh, don't you worry. We have lots to talk about, just like when we got to know each other on Zoom. And, you know when it's going to be a great guest and dynamic when we just, I think 2 hours just about went by almost. It was awesome. We're like, whoa, man, where'd the time go? Yeah, very riveting listening to you. So Susan wrote to me, galloping along a herd of giraffes, walking up to grazing rhinoceros and observing resting lions on horseback as a helper on riding safaris in South Africa was a return to my roots in distance riding and a final fracturing of my life as a professional dressage trainer in Southern California. In 2011, I was beginning a deeper search of answers for myself. Was it with the ancient land of Africa and the amazing collection of free-roaming animals in expansive parks reserves? Was it the lifestyle and use of the horses as vehicles that was still haunting me? She writes, how do we coexist with animals that need to live as a herd in expansive areas when the option is at a global premium? Yes. Yeah, I have a lot to say about that. In my experience, listening to what the horses need naturally and instinctively and doing our best to set our environments up for them. Even if you have limited property, there's so much you can do to help them feel at home and safe in their environment and in meeting their instinctual needs. Because it's hard. One of them is roaming when you don't have a lot of property. What do you do otherwise to help? We can talk more about that. She writes, next stop, Jaipur. Is that how you say that? Jaipur, India?
Jaipur.
Jaipur. Jaipur, India. India was never on my travel list, Susan writes, but this is often how the biggest fracturing can unfold. I love that word fracturing. That's a good one. As I walked out of the hotel the first morning, there were cows everywhere resting and roaming free on a congested concrete savanna. What unfolded in the scheduled 2-week visit to India led me to fold up a successful horse sales business, training with Olympic coaches in a serious ballroom dancing pursuit. Living in a pink cement room smaller than most horses' stalls with a ceiling fan was a lifestyle that supported 3 intense years of self-inquiry in India. Early on, my teacher said that my study in life with the horses had prepared me for this next step. Over 10 years later, I better understand why. Unwinding deep inner layers of unnecessary beliefs was the work. Don't we do this for horses as well? I continue to return to India for seven more years because the self-inquiry work is ongoing. Yes, it is. Currently, my life on a farm in rural Kentucky, Horsewoods Haven, is allowing me to put all of it together into practice. The awareness is a step, but the integration into daily life is the work. Beautifully put. Beautiful. Yay. Welcome. So awesome. Yeah. So there's so much to talk about, beginning with, I've got a series of questions for you. But the first one's going to be, we talked about this in an email exchange too, sharing all of us, the three of us, our observations around harmonizing with the horses as preparation for something more structured like riding. And I think, speaking for myself, my audience, whether it's my YouTube crowd or Facebook or, my students, how they find me, that's what we're all searching for. We're here of like mind, the three of us and everyone listening. That's the beauty of listening to a podcast right now
with people with, you know, with us, with, if we have a lot of experience in this area, how we can share how to create that harmony with our horses. As we just said, in preparation for riding in harmony, I know I have got a complete program myself. That's my mastery membership relationship ground and riding foundation program. So I get that, you know, that's what my program is all about, is creating that bond and that relationship. And that it is, in my work, a spiritual journey, because we're looking at things holistically. You know, we're looking at the emotions, the mental and the physical well-being of horse and rider together. It's not just about horses when we're developing or training, nor should it be, because how do we find harmony if we're not both searching? You know, the horse may not be, but we're coming as a human from the mindset that we ourselves need to synchronize and align ourselves with the horse so that there's harmony. And what does that feel like? What does that look like? Because so often everyone's thrown into learning quick fixes and technique. And technique's important, especially coming from your dressage background. I have a working equitation. I'm a certified working equitation instructor here in Florida. So my whole foundation of riding is based on the classical principles and systematic approach, you know, to developing the horse from the inside out. That systematic, that old school, where we take our time, we methodically work, we wait, we meet the horse where the horse is, we don't push them until that push is a healthy push, right? Get them out of their comfort a little bit. But you also want to create that, how do I want to put it? That thing, you know, that mindset within your horse, for lack of a better word, where they have no fear of learning, where they're confident learners. Mm. And that's a huge problem in the horse world, is there are too many unconfident horses. You know, they're not confident in anything, let alone learning something new. And that's a, I just can open up a whole can of worms. But for you, Susan, you know, please start with, what's your take on sharing your observations around harmonizing with horses as a preparation for something more structured like riding? I'm sure that has to do with the program you've created.
Well, you know, just like you, I mean, the horses have led me on every part of my path since I was 3 years old, sitting under horses mm-hmm. in the field. You know, when I reflect on it, it's like they've been my motivation and the guide to find something deeper. So yes. it's sort of ironic to look back and how I've been led even here to Kentucky. So one of the things that I'm learning being here as a steward of them, one of my goals was to have a facility that they never stood in mud. They didn't have to stand really in flies. And, you know, all of these things that we are kind of, when they're in smaller boutique settings, we manage them, but I'm still trying to do it in a more natural way. I mean, my horses do come in. I find they, you know, they get better about flies, but some horses, they just, you know, they need fly mass. And so aren't we fortunate mm-hmm. we have yes. all these things? So what I've learned, which is really interesting living with them, and I'm sure you have this at your facility. Normally I was a professional who would go to the facility. And then, mm-hmm. you know, once you step out of your car, you're in their zone and then you're operating and then you step out. But it's so different to be here 24/7. So it's like we have a sensing. And I've noticed that the more I'm here, like yesterday, I go, well, I was thinking, oh, they could come in now or they could stay out. It's going to be their choice. They're going to have a little more flies if they stay out. Next thing you know, here they come galloping across the field, you know, like, hey, let's go ahead and come in now, because I had to make a call that was going to take an hour. And so I find those sort of things, like somebody could say, oh, you're making that up, but it isn't. You know that from the design.
Like, it's telepathy.
Right? I mean,
it's telepathy. We talk about it all the time. Yep, yeah, I talk about it all the time. If you're listening, they will figure it out, because some of them are, you know, some of them are too scared. Some of them have too much trauma. They're not open. But when a horse feels they can trust you, and they're going to open up to you, they're going to have a lot to say. And the more they have a voice and we're listening, then the two-way telepathy is outrageous. Yes, all the time. They read your mind. Mm-hmm.
But it's beautiful.
And they want to work with you.
No, it's beautiful because I've been experimenting with rescuing horses at one of the local auctions, and it isn't really the auction's fault. It's a disposable nature of horses. So I've rescued, there was a standard bred, it turned out, Harlan, that he'd won $250,000 and then was just discarded. And, you know, another one is Gracie, a Tennessee Walker. And I have all these breeds. It's like the, you know, small Kentucky horse park out here at Horsewoods Haven. But I've been learning about new breeds. Like, I'm not as familiar with the gated world. But my point is more that they come. And as a horse trainer, I was known for being really adept at problem solving horses, meaning finding a way for them to find harmony in the structure of riding. And that I would notice.
So let me stop you right there. Let me stop you. I'm not going to be rude, but I do that. I'm going to stop you because that's a good point. I'm going to ask you a question. In my pursuit of finding harmony in riding, my pursuit was for me to learn how to ride in harmony with the horse. And that's what my whole riding approach is about and method. And the reason why I'm putting it that way is when I got back into horses and I was studying with some top classical dressage, you know, for the Olympics, bronze medalists. And I was frustrated, you know, here I am showing up bitless and a bareback pad. They're like, no, you got to wear a helmet. You got to get a saddle. And my biggest question, and I bounced around from many of them until I could find a few of them that would work with me the way I wanted to be worked with. But my biggest question was, I don't want to learn how to ride by riding my horse. I want to learn how to get in rhythm. I want to learn how to get in harmony with my horse in thought, in heart, intention, and focus, in heart, in relationship. And then I want to learn how to move, because my biggest inspiration was my little Arabian that I unfortunately had to put down last year. So he was doing tempi lead changes. He was doing the Piaf all on his own. He was a magnificent little Arabian and mover. And I'm like, I would take him to these professionals and I'm like, well, I just want to learn how to ride the movement. No, you need 2 years of rising trot and you need him on the bit and in contact. I'm like, no, but he does this on his own. Every horse can do these beautiful maneuvers on their own. Why do I want to interfere besides building strength and balance? Absolutely. So that the horse can take a balanced rider. I get all that. But my biggest quest, and this is part of the, as a pioneer, I feel, because I'm educating people and I'd love to get your take on this coming from a classically trained background is I disagree with all of that though. I'm like, we need to become harmonious with the horse. We need to learn how to move with the horse's movement. We can refine the movement, obviously through training, like I said, and get better strength and better balance and better self-carriage and better collection. But other than building them as an athlete, the horse, we have an obligation and responsibility to not try to learn how to ride by torturing the horse. We need to learn those things to me. And I teach that on the ground too, on the ground to be the best rider so that we can get in sync with our horses. And it's going to go back and forth. You know, I want the horse to mirror me, but so many people aren't learning how to ride a horse's movement. They're not learning how to ride it. They're just learning how to post it or sit it or control it, but they don't know how to allow that movement to come through their body so that when they and their horse are connected, you can ask for that movement. The horse understands because that's what it feels like in their body. Does that make sense?
It does, but I think that relates. I mean, listening to that, you figure in the origins of horse training and riding, people were on the lunge line and they were learning to ride without reins and stirrups. And so they embodied that feel of the horse.
But
right?
Hold on, that's a great point. But wait, yes. So this is how things have gotten bastardized and misunderstood. You're absolutely right. I talk about classical all the time. All the years you develop the horse before you put the rider on, and then all the years you develop them, and there's your 7 years of the Spanish school of riding, so to speak. Problem is nobody's teaching it correctly but the few. So all my students, everybody out there is learning this general riding techniques and training where they're lunging people who've never ridden before. They're lunging them immediately on horses that do not have collection. They are not balanced. And so you're getting this abrasive, you know, resistant, saddles don't fit. I mean, look at all this stuff. And people are out there taking lessons on horses whose movement has not been developed fully. So it's not a fluid, smooth movement. It's a abrasive, unbalanced movement. And then they're throwing these people on to learn lunging. This is what's out there in the general public. So you may have never taught that at your level. But most people aren't learning at that level. And that's what I'm teaching in my program, though. That's what I'm trying to say, is that people need to come. You shouldn't wait until you seek out a professional dressage instructor. You know, at the rudimentary level of basic horsemanship and riding lessons, it's like educationally, we have to change everything because people are learning the wrong way and horses are not developed and prepared to handle. Can you imagine? I mean, nobody knows how to do a sitting trot. Nobody learns sitting trot. Everybody learns rising trot immediately. It's nuts to me. There's no harmonizing.
But I think it's a concern. Like, why? I think you almost have to step deeper than that, because you have to understand, which I don't always understand, why is it that somebody can watch a human be contracted on a horse and the horse being contracted? Why is that okay to be standing there watching that? So is it education, or is it, what is that? You know, that's a lot of it. I mean,
there's levels of consciousness.
Yeah.
I think levels of consciousness.
But what's available? Because I'm going to even say, you know, there's a lot of holes in dressage. I would say the principles are there. You read the master's books and all the pieces. Like, I still feel like dressage is the most remarkable toolkit ever, but it's always how it's applied. So, you know, for whatever reason, I grew up, the first year I had a horse, I didn't own a saddle or a bareback pad, and I learned to ride. Looking back, I have no idea how I lived and how I survived that. I mean, my parents said, okay, I begged from the age of 3, could I get a horse? And at age 10, they said, okay, somebody had an old barrel racing horse for me to lease. I had never had a riding lesson other than being put on the ponies by the mean girls. And then the ponies would run off to the barn, you'd fall off. And, you know, the thing is, I never gave up, but you just keep going, right? So I have no idea the miracle that I survived that year, right? But then what happened was, over the course of my riding, I guess that installed some software or hardware that gave me a sense of being fluid with the horse, because the horse, her name was Mariah. She was tall enough that I couldn't jump on from the ground. So I never wanted to fall off because I'd have to find something to get on her. And so, you know, as I took instructions, everybody always said, oh, you have great feel and timing. And I never understood that. But I will tell you this. It was really interesting. I was working with one of the, I did all the USDF certification. I was encouraged to do that. It was interesting in the United States. And so I remember that I was riding along and I was being observed, and they were complimenting how I was riding. And I was highly disturbed because I felt like a tin soldier would feel on a horse. And I remember thinking, I think at that time I was riding pre-St. George or something. I was like, is this really what it's about? And because I had started out riding endurance riding, completing Tevas, the good fortune to do NATRC, which is a fabulous way to start in horses, because you learn to ride the terrain, you learn obstacles, how to handle your horse, how to stable it. It's an amazing sport. And so I kept thinking that when I saw this beautiful riding called dressage, that it was going to feel beautiful also. Like, I just assumed that, But then it was so ironic to get to a point where it wasn't about the feel of beauty and harmony. And so even at the end, when I got really frustrated and disillusioned, because I knew the principles were there in the work and I loved the horses, but I kept remembering my childhood of, you know, you go out and you take your peanut butter and jelly sandwich and you're gone.
The freedom of it.
Right?
Yes.
The peanut water or you drink out of a creek. And so you keep thinking, well, that it's going to be that only doing all these beautiful movements. Mm-hmm. And so.
Yes.
No. And I still to this day search for instruction that would guide me in that. And because my one of my last instructors, she was so lovely. She was so patient because I was absolutely fierce at that point. And she watched me ride. I took a year off. I just rode a group of horses and I said, okay, do or die. I'm going to just ride the way I think at this point, you know, that I can do the best I can. Take it under supervision, somebody that judges Grand Prix dressage, and find out if it was just a mess what I did all year. So when I went to her with the group of three horses, she said, it's fantastic what you're doing, but nobody is going to take that time. So I at least got an answer. But I think like your audience and people, there are people out there. It isn't about time. It's about the relationship. Mm-hmm. And the insight from the 20 years of ballroom dancing where I was a horse right away changed because I realized the timing, the feel, the alignment of the person leading me was absolutely critical for how I could respond. And so I think all of us in this group, we know that intrinsically in your audience, but until you feel that, it's those aha moments, right? Where all of a sudden it just becomes incredibly clear. Because I was one of those dancers who I was like the thoroughbred that always was in front of the aids, not behind the aids, in front of the aids. Because if they made a suggestion, then I was like, okay, I'm doing 150%. I'm going. I don't want to be called out for being lazy or unresponsive or, you know, all the things, right? But then when I remember he was a national champion, I was very fortunate. I had gotten to train with really good coaches. And he said, no, you don't understand. You're too quick. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I could reflect on the horse, right? That there's that, the real harmonizing is the horse to be ready, confident, but present and balanced in a way that it can respond in a fluid, engaged, connected way. Now, if you look at a dressage book, it says all that.
I know.
You know, it was why I went off to Portugal.
That was my quest.
Yeah. Right. Wanted to study. I was
going
to study.
Unlike you, though. You had some great instructors.
Yeah. No, but I, you know, and he passed away, you know, Oliveira 2 weeks before I got there. So I was a little like, oh, now what? And then I got shifted over to Senor Luis Valenza and his amazing daughters. And it was stunning, you know, and I think like you, that was a part of it. But riding those round, kind of naturally engaged horses, one of the things when I came home I lacked was really understanding throughness. And throughness was the big key for more horses that are rectangular and other shapes. So that aligned readiness in the horse. So then you ask, how do you find calm, aligned, but engaged, willing qualities in the horse? Now, you and I know from all our trail riding, I did Tevis. I completed Tevis. It's a pretty difficult 100-mile ride. So for the horse to take on going up Cougar Rock or, you know, through the ravines and all the parts, they have those qualities, don't they?
Yes.
You're not going to pull on the reins and kick to get up Cougar Rock. By that time, the horse has to be knowing itself. So you become you lead the horse to the base and then you follow. So it's just constant lead, follow, lead, follow. But I mean, maybe I'm off tangent now, but one of the big differences that people said about how I approached riding was I believed in the mind of the horse, that I was developing the how the horse was willing to be in the partnership of riding. And I think, again, the distance riding really cued me up for that, because my friends that rode with me, I used to torture them because I was always riding off trail. And so we were always foraging our wild ways through the, you know, crazy stuff. So, but you learn, right, in that to trust the horse. And there would be things, I'm sure you had this too, where you'd be like, well, okay, it's your choice. If you say no, then I know, no, we shouldn't be doing that. And then if they said, okay, I learned something usually about how they could manage going through something that seemingly complicated, a rock face or whatever it is. So taught me early on that honoring of the mind. And I'll have to credit also Senor Valenza. He has so much passion for the horse. So I was so fortunate to go in my beginning dressage to somebody who actually really loves and cares for the horse. And he always said that most of the work was in the preparation. I think it was like 80 or 90% was the preparation. And then it's the allowing in the execution. And that there's that rock face, right? Going up the rock face. And then I think I shared with you that at the end of my, I'd been dancing 18 years and I had turned to Charlotta. She was a I think one time world champion or second in the world. I said, when are we getting to the essence of dancing? Because I'd learned all this technique and I was quite adept. And where's the essence? So when she turned me on to her godfather, Hans Luxholm, who had won a world champion and then was coaching world champions, he had created this system that was a feedback system. That's where the band came from, the integrative band and self seeds, to get feedback in yourself so that you could give feedback to your partner and you become this like two rubber bands together. And that is what I thought riding would be. I thought that's what dressage was going to be, was this shared reverberation, you know, in and out, almost like a tube torus, right? The in and out.
Yes.
That you're it should mind, be. Body, spirit, soul, that you're sharing this wave together was my thinking. And we know there's a lot of
the movement.
There's a lot of disillusion in that. And even I will say, and I don't want to be a naysayer because when you have those moments that are that, it's beautiful. But I also realized in dancing, there isn't a lot of that either, even though it looks amazing. So this is where, not to skip ahead, but I feel like the biggest thing that we need to work on is feel.
Yeah,
I say feel, timing, and alignment, but feel is the preciousness of living in these three-dimensional plus dimensional bodies, right?
Yes.
And yes, so absolutely. I don't know. I just feel at this point, I'm, you know, 58 and I'm out here doing my thing, trying to learn from the horses. And I realize feel is sacred. Feel is actually sacred.
So I've had some discussions with some of my students over the years about feel, and some of them, and I've had discussions with other professionals in the horse world so the horse world, and then also energy practitioners, like you can't teach feel, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard that in our industry, but you can't teach feel, either they have it or they don't. And I totally disagree with that. Like you just said, we all have the capacity to feel on so many different levels. Intellectually, we can comprehend, and there's a feeling that our nervous system connects to that creates from that thought creates a somatic experience. There's, you know, the whole empathy and compassion and feeling of and for your horse. Absolutely. And then there's the, again, somatic or visceral or kinesthetic experience of how the movement. The biggest thing I see, and this is in alignment with what you're talking about out there, is students are not being taught feel. And it's either being reserved for the upper level echelon of students that have a natural talent, natural feel, that are fluid riders, and then they're picked and see, you know, picked up immediately by instructors who want to do something with them. But then there's the rest of everybody who's like, okay, you just taught me to take a lesson on a horse, and I've never ridden, or I've only done a walk and a trot, and now you want me to trot and canter. And so there's no one's being told what's going on in your body. And if you're scared, what does that feel like, so that you listen to that fear and don't end up getting hurt because you didn't listen to that. And so, yeah, it's a big deal out there. I don't know. I deal with most of my clientele is just backyard horse owners that enjoy, you know, the sport of horsemanship, whether it's clinics or versatility, a little bit of dressage, trail riding, reining, a little bit of this jumping, but they're not professionals. I have some, but the majority of them are not. So they just want this safe, amazing partnership, you know, with their horse, and they're not being taught that. It doesn't matter if it's natural horsemanship. It doesn't matter if it's English equitation lessons. It seems like there's the way that the trainers out there, on a very, like I said, rudimentary, generic level of training, just the whole of them, all of them across the board, are just, they don't know enough. And they're hurting their students and their horses by far more than they're helping. And it has so much to do with what you're talking about, starting out really slow and capturing that feel and learning how to think of and for the horse and not being pressured. And in, where's the joy in it for you and the horse? Where's the horse's joy in this? Why aren't we meeting their needs and making their life happy in this process? So where's the relationship, right? Where's the bonding that we know is so important, that connection piece to the horse that's so important to them as a socially intelligent, sentient being? So there's all those layers of feel that is absolutely not being taught. And you, as a professional student and trainer yourself, an instructor, you're saying, you know, even at the high levels, and I've seen this, I've watched it, I've studied it at the higher levels, you're seeing that there's not the feel's abandoned, just like in ballroom dancing. It's more of the technique, but where's the chemistry? Like, to me, that harmonizing is a chemistry. When you click with someone, you know, whether it's your dance partner, your best friend, you know, your lover, your spouse, your partner, your friends, your horses, you click. What's that click? It's chemistry. We need to keep nurturing that. Right? That's part of that feel. I love you. I feel loved. I care about you.
No, and I think it's interesting because even in classical training, I mean, I started that way and then I went to competitive because, you know, as a professional, you need to find a way to make a living or have the accolades. And I mean, I'm a student.
And you're in the United States and it's competitive.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, the thing was, even when I watched classical training in Europe, there's some that's done horrifically. It's not a guarantee. So I think this is what, and then one thing that happened, which was fascinating for me, and typically I had always worked for myself, right? So you create your own environment and, you know, so you, sometimes you're kind of secluded in a way. And my kids would go, you know, we'd go and do, I think we were doing quadrilles at the time. I was fascinated by quadrilles because of being in Europe with Señor Valencia. He did all these wonderful exhibitions. And I get a lot of compliments on the position of the kids. And I mean, there was 6-foot kids riding 14-2 and Arabs. And there was, you know, little kid. Yeah, I mean, you get it. It's like you said. And it was a joy because you're just creating harmony, timing, how they work together. It was so fun. But then when I came back from India, I wasn't sure if I would, where I was in the horse world. So I ended up working for a professional, I mean, very well-intentioned hunter jumper trainer. I had done years of schooling horses on the flat for hunters and jumpers. So I did that. And what I learned was that it was based a lot on patterning. Now, ironically, one of my childhood mentors, Nancy Kasevich, I actually, my first book was about her, her life through the eyes of the horse. And what she taught me was that in her life had been a professional trainer, polo, top gold polo players in the United States. And that was when polo was really an art of polo. And she talked to how in the wave of the development of riding, when not to throw amateurs under the bus, but it changed the whole circuit of the horse world. Because she said what a lot of trainers did, because they knew how to do things, but not how to teach. It started a whole wave of teaching patterning. And so in the advent of the patterning, all these things that you and I are talking about is, we're going to say, a horseman's point of view, the partnering, the relationship. It isn't, I think that people were, I mean, the trainer that I worked for, she was very kind. She did good food. Yes. Did, you know, I mean, the care.
Good ethics. Good ethics.
The ethics. Yeah. Thank you for that. But the patterning. So it was sort of a mess, because she would ask me to train the horses, and I would sort of sort out the feel of the horses. And then I said, well, it really would be better if I could teach a little bit so I could harmonize the rider with this feel difference, right? Mm-hmm. And what I learned watching these students take on kind of, I'm going to say, like a reconstruction, and it wasn't really intentional. It's just because that's where I operated from with dressage and my background. But all of a sudden, they started to change their fear levels. And they're, you know, they were jumping. And so a lot of times with the patterning and low jumps, you can kind of force yourself to be kind of rigid, but fixed on the horse. And you do these, you know, patterning, right?
Yes.
And again, there wasn't maliciousness, but it was quite troubling for the horses. And then the deep dive, when I had the freedom, when they'd let me loose to just teach them the way I wanted to, I would put them all in a file. I called it a file. And I would have them jump as a file, like fun, following each other, and then change who was in front. But they were terrified in the beginning, because I was trying to simulate them riding like we would when we were kids out galloping in the woods and up and down and through the creek. Because we'd go out with our buddies, right? And we'd be like galloping like mad people and racing cars and just doing all that. So I wanted in a very safe way to kind of see like what's under the hood with these kids, right? I mean, they look shiny objects, but what's under there? So, you know, they were great kids, but you realize like they were, that was really troubling. But when they started to get it, it allowed them then to be, have freedom in the jumping. Or I'll never forget, there was a girl that was afraid of the horse bucking. So what happens, right? She's a very good rider. But so, of course, the horse lets out this huge buck. And she stayed on and did like an incredible job. But that moment, because it was standing there cheerleading how she was going to get through that moment, and she did it, it changed her whole relationship with jumping and the horse, because she could live the mechanics. So I think one thing I learned, not that any of us loved getting bucked off, but you figure our horses did rearing and courbettes and jumped over things and pee off. And we did all that stuff, right? Not in an organized way, but we did it all. And so with that, you learn then all the elasticity and all the different ways. And then I spent a long time, and I still love it, actually, starting young horses. I don't use a round penning system, but I love that the intimacy of the first time they're experiencing a human and how they they adapt and they feel the weight distribution and all the little nuances. And so yes. it changes their fear. So changing the rider's fear by them having this flexibility and dexterity on the horse, that's really lost because of liability, right? People yes. come, they're in a hurry. They've got five other things they have to do. They come in, they're tense. They have to hop on the horse. Maybe there's even a groom. And they get on. They're not even thinking how they're leading the horse to the mounting block, right? Like to me, mm-hmm. I knew right. the whole world that was unfolding by just feeling the rein while I'm walking the horse to the mounting block, right?
Well, right there. But right there, oh. Susan, right there, it starts with just being present. And people, everyone in our huge, you know, we keep, our technology keeps advancing and growing. And you know, we're all on devices instead of having that one-on-one, more intimate social contact. So we're not, it all starts with being present, being attuned. Like you said, you when you took the rein and you led the horse to the mounting block, you knew what was going on by the feel, what you felt. Yes. We need to be taught there. You know, you take your horse, you groom your horse, you tack your horse up, you see where your horse is at. And, you know, it, unfortunately, I keep going back to that's just systematically the way most people are being taught, though. They're not being taught the way I'm teaching, the way you're teaching, where no, we're going to slow down. We're going to pay attention. This is how you avoid accidents. It doesn't mean you want to get in your body so that you can handle a spook. You can handle a horse that jumps 3 feet. You can handle a horse that sits down low and spins and tries to go the other way. Yeah, we have to be prepared. It's only fair to help the person be prepared for what naturally is going to happen. No matter how well trained your horse is, those things can still happen. You just have better control through your body by going with the movement and then seizing control, and the horse having more self-regulation, right, in connection to you. But that's what I keep driving home through this podcast too, is 98% of the trainers and instructors out there aren't teaching this way. You know, they might be training, but when it comes to teaching, they're not. They're missing these valuable pieces at the very beginning that help us tune in, become a tuning fork, I call it in my work. Attune to your surroundings, attune to your horse, attune to yourself. You know, where are all of we in this learning experience or this beingness, even if we just want to be with our horse? You know, what is going on? It's a lot of more students have accidents because they're not being taught this, right? They end up on the bucking, bolting horse and then they're scared to death. And the you know, it's.
But I'm going to say, you know, one of the problems, though, and this isn't just the trainers, okay? One is that we recognize there's a fitness involved with riding. You know, when people try to tell me that, oh, you don't have to be fit to ride, I'm like, okay, come on out, right? So there's a fitness, and I would say another big one is how horses live. So when horses are living confined in stalls, yes. and they aren't managed, running them on the lunge or sedating them isn't really an answer, right? So it gets very complicated, doesn't it? I always tried, I learned from the horses that having adequate turnout was a big game changer for safety. And I'm in turnout, not
emotionally,
not 10 mm-hmm. minutes. You know, it wasn't a 10-minute turnout or a chase in the round pen or something. And I know that it's gotten to a point. I mean, it was eye-opening for me in some of the places in Southern California when there's 500 horses living in stalls. I get it. I don't want to criticize that. I mean, we love horses and we're going to find a way. But is there a place where if we're going to have a horse, that we have to honor things that are the horse? You know, mm-hmm. and I think that's where an equisizer and some other ways are added in there. But that's part of the trouble. And then people want to blame the horse. And if the horse wasn't started properly, like you said, it has fear or holes or things that are disturbing, you know, and then that gets escalated when the horse isn't managed. So, I mean, it's so many tiers, isn't it? It's so many tiers. So the trainers are a piece of the puzzle and how they oversee the management and what they teach. But it's more than that, right?
There's a lot of missing education, like what you're saying, and a lot of taking responsibility for the horse's well-being environmentally, working with us. You don't just take your horse out, like you said, and run the hell out of them when it takes them 10 to 15 minutes at a working walk warm up just to release all the lactic acid that needs to get into all their joints and muscles and tendons, or they can tie up, you know. It's like, what are we? It's just so, it's really heartbreaking when you think what we do to our horses, that a lot of it's just a lack of education. Cause like you said, we love our horses. Everybody loves their horses. We all want that special time with their horses, whatever that time is, but it's that education. I wish we could all, as professional horse people, the professionals out there that are influencing and educating, we could all come to a consensus that people, you know, our students, we need to learn certain things from the beginning. You know, we need to learn certain specifics of so that whatever discipline we choose or way of sport, you know, or way of working with our horses, that at least we have this foundation of togetherness with the horse and attunement and what's going to be best for the horse in this process, right? Sentient being.
No, but I bet, like you, I never thought it was going to be anything but that. So it was interesting. Like, there were times that I did things to horses that I'm embarrassed by, you know, because I didn't know and I was being guided to get things done, right? And I hope in my next lifetime I'll probably be a horse and have somebody, you know, and they said I was never terrible, but I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? You know, but those things, I never thought about going down the trail or riding 100 miles with any other intention than partnering. So is it the competition? And then it's hard because it's an expensive sport. It's not a broom that you put in a closet. And then people have expectations, right? They have expectations of results. Yes. And
it's
so
a lot
you
of
just
education.
See how all these parts get all mashed in there. I think I watch some of the developing professionals that are at the brink of being quite our next set of stars in dressage. And there's a couple that are really hanging to the quality of the horse, the integrity of the horse. And it warms my heart. So it's not that it's impossible, but I think, as you have to have the right clients. You have to have clients that want to get there, not at any expense, but they want to get there in alignment to the horse. And that's a different person. It's a different owner. It's a different part of the path, right? Even the racehorse industry, here I am, I'm in the middle of the thick of the you know, racehorse.
Yes.
Is if a lot of those horses were started in a different system, they would be easily more reshaped to then go to the next part of their life. And I bet that those owners, it isn't that they're an advocate of the horse not having basics. They just don't know.
And
so they're swimming in that right stream. So it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I really applaud you. These are hard conversations. And I have to say, you know, this is the stuff that I kind of live and die for, I think, is to be able to work out the nuances, but it's exhausting for people, right?
It can be. I think, you know, again, like I said, it's unanimously, the horse industry does not purport what you and I are doing. Unanimously. I'm not saying that we don't have some superstars, you know, out there, but it's the general public is learning the wrong things, you know, they're going about it. If you want to seek harmony with the horse, you must seek harmony within you. You have to learn what that looks like. It's not just a mechanical thing. The mechanics should be the end result. When you go to test the beautiful harmony, is the mechanics soft and responsive and fluid? And like you said, the energy is through the horse, and like an elastic rubber band, we can move as one in any direction. But yeah, this either being saved for the upper level, you know, being saved for people that instructors want to spend time with and that have a lot of money, but it's not being taught to the general masses. And it's unfortunate. There is a spiritual shift. There is a definite spiritual shift out there. More and more people like us, you know, are searching for deeper, more connected ways in harmony with our horses through and being able to include that in the riding, include that in the mechanics, include that in lunging. For one, my whole lunging program is oneness. You know, first we're going to learn how to become one, move as one, so we can ride as one. Those are the three main principles. And it takes relationship, self-regulation, and flow, and learning those throughout everything you do until you embody it, right? Horse has it. We need to embody it. And we need to get in that place so that we come and meet the horse there. So
but, I think though, because of how horses live, they don't always have it.
Yes, they do. Oh, yes, they do. Oh, yes, they do.
I think that it depends on degrees, because if you look at throughness in a really true level with the horse, you know, lifting through the thoracic sling and all that aspect, it's a different feel than a horse moving in a soft, fluid way. They are, I would say,
it's powerful.
They are different, right? Because one has power and you can link it up in a sequence easier. The other is just a general sense of harmony. So I think there are levels in that, depending on.
Well, let me back up. Yeah, that's taking it in another direction. When I say yes, all horses, I'm going saying yes to the harmony that all horses. So studying wild horses and working with wild horses is what I've done too. And the wild horses can so vastly different than our domesticated horses. So when you say, you know, yes, wild horses are always in harmony. They're always in harmony, and they're so athletic. You know, obviously they grind their own teeth. They trim their own hooves, and they're in great, amazing shape, obviously, to be able to travel miles every day. So to me, the horse itself is designed to find and seek harmony emotionally, mentally, and physically, to find that level of balance. But again, we don't know that as a domestic. That's something that I had to totally learn when I got back into horses. And I studied the wild. I had the freedom, or the, not freedom, isn't the right word. I had the, not luxury, but I lived near Chincoteague and Assateague Island in Maryland. So first experience with wild horses, was studying them, riding on the beaches when they were open, studying them, being with them, and also working with the wild ponies. And so, oh my gosh, yeah, crazy. I mean, yeah, I've had some nut jobs. I mean, really feral, you know, wild stallions that had to get cut, that would have jumped through over my round pen, you know, to get out and get to the mares if they could. It's just educating people, because most people only have experienced their domesticated horse. So they think all these behaviors that horses have are normal, or all these ways of aggressive behavior or defensive behavior or brace through the body is normal, you know? I'm coinciding with what you're talking about. We just have to become more educated and educate people that this isn't normal. And this is how we can seek harmony with the horse, and how we can help the horse's body to its unique fullest potential in agility. You gotta study and understand. You know, I read something very powerful a long time ago, and this is what I believe to this day, until, you know, I'm taught something else. But passage is one of the toughest maneuvers, the passage for a horse, and that what I believe and what I've studied, and I've heard different philosophies from master trainers and professionals, you know, I believe that for a horse to do a perfect, beautiful natural passage. It must come, they must be born with it. And then you take that gift and that talent in the horse and you refine it versus any horse. You know, they're making any horse do the passage. Every horse should be able to do the passage. And to me, that's just one of, you just either have that lift, that body, you know, the expression, the cadence, as well as the physical body that's just born to be able to give that specific movement. Not every horse, I believe, is born or that talented. What's your thought on that, Susan?
Lydia, did you have a question?
You said like Lovey, maybe?
Oh.
Yeah, no, yeah. Lovey, my thoroughbred off the track, was born to do the passage. She does the passage like that. Born. Not the pee off. She can do the pee off, but she does the passage all the time. And she's got that lift like an Arab. She's got the dish in the face like an Arab. That whole bloodline has, that thoroughbred bloodline has a, you know, remarkable Arabian traits, remarkable, but she moves like an Arabian. No wonder why she didn't win any races, right, guys? Because she has that extra hang time, that float, you know, that extra hang time in the air. God, and that's another good point. I say this all the time. If I was a thoroughbred trainer for the track, or the owner that bred her or bought her, wouldn't you see that this is not a racehorse? She spends more time in the air than she does like a cheetah. I want a horse where the hind legs come up. If they're going to race, the hind legs are coming up like a cheetah and almost surpassing the front legs, right? And that would be my little thoroughbred Blue that's born naturally to run like a cheetah, low and way, you know, flat and just reaching. And Lovey's up in the air, up in the air, up in the air. I'm like, hello, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you think she's going to be fast?
But I think, again, you know, it's great. I mean, you have a chance that you study a lot of horses. So you see that. But I think probably all horses could do some degree of passage. It depends on the preparation. Definitely. And all of that.
So, but not perfectly. Like, I think it's cruel when you are trying to make a fourth level dressage horse do the passage and it's okay. You know, it's, my point is, don't force it. This is, you know, maybe you need a better trainer, but sometimes, you know, our horses are like us. We're only built for certain things. I don't care what your bloodlines are. Lovey's bloodline is a top racing bloodline and she's not a racehorse. You see what I'm saying?
But I
She's
think,
a dressage horse.
But I'm guessing, see, I see this. It's a great question. It's a really good question. And I do have an opinion. I see it in the jumping world, too, that maybe a horse is really comfortable at 3 feet. But what happens is, and then they try to make it a 3,600 and it's struggling and blah, blah.
Yes.
But I mean, wouldn't you agree that part of what happens is the person is coming along in their sequence, and maybe they didn't, when they had this horse, they didn't really think ahead that their goal was going to be to do Piaf and passage. And maybe through good training and care and dedication, they got farther in their path than they ever expected. And the horse did too. And so rather than buying a new horse and starting over, or having the money to buy one that's already there, you try to squeeze. Would it be like trying to squeeze a lemon, you know? And I think this is what I saw, is that horses, whether it was jumping or dressage or whatever, I'm not as familiar with the Western world, but I hear reports is that that's how it gets kind of twisted and sideways instead of honoring. And then, you know, there, I'm going to say the other side of that, because I, you know, live in that. People have a checkbook. And maybe they cannot sit or ride the quality of a gait that they've just purchased.
Yes.
So then what happens? The horse becomes quite troubled. You have the other part where the trainer buys a horse more suitable for themselves, which is naughty. Mm-hmm. Unless it's the agreement. I mean, if the buyer has said, I want to buy you a horse to elevate your career, of course. And I'd like to every now and then sit on it. No problem. But you have to understand the agreement, right? And so then that's how I think, to answer your question, there's so many tentacles, they get sort of twisted. And then I'll say another one. When I was learning to be a L trainer, or I was looking into being a dressage judge. So I did the L program.
Okay.
And so you're looking, they're coaching you on how to give numbers for results, right? But then you see, like, where do you start? Because I'm going to say there's kind of two aspects of dressage. There's the horse that's developing with the idea that it's going to be an advanced level horse. So all the inner work, the throughness, the straightness, the collection, it's being built to get somewhere. Versus there's a layer in dressage where people are riding a horse doing movements, but they don't necessarily have true engagement or collection or self-carriage. But you can get really far in the movements, doing movements, and not have kind of the guts of the horse, I'm going to say, harmonized. And and as a consumer, as a student, you're having faith in your trainer. How do you always know which of those paths you that you're on?
That's education. Here we go again. So my last instructor, my last instructor that I got pissed off with and fired here in Florida, not my working equitation instructor. She's amazing. And she's retired many, many years ago. But anyway, this one instructor, I brought Sundance, my late quarter horse mare, who was so talented, but definitely struggling with some arthritis. And I brought her to a lesson, and he decided I was going to ride one of his clients' horses. And I had asked him that I wanted to ride one of his horses. You know, if I'm going to be taught by somebody, I don't just want a trainer, an instructor that trains the horses. I also want an instructor that can ride them. I want to see, I already knew how he rode, but I wanted to see I wanted to ride one of his polished horses, more advanced horses. So he sticks, and I already saw this client's horse of his. I'd seen him working with this horse before, and this horse was not talented. It was a PRE Andalusian gelding, white, built like a tank. I mean, like a rhinoceros. I'd never seen a PRE Andalusian built like this, nor have I ever worked with one built like this. And he's clunky. He was not talented. And I'd seen my instructor a few times when he was still working with this horse, when I would pull up, I'd seen him asking for more than this horse could produce. And that rubbed me the wrong way. So now I brought Sundance. I come for a double lesson, one to ride his schoolmaster. And then I want to take that feel and see where I am with Sundance.
Bart.
Well, he sticks me on his client's horse, and he wants me to feel the pee-off. And first, you know, I said, listen, no offense, I'm paying for this. Obviously, I'm the student paying for this lesson. I'm going to spend as much time as I need to feel this horse. Do not push me into X, Y, and Z. Here we go into a pattern. And I told him, I said, don't push me into this. So I was already getting hit in my max with him. And this was ended up being our last lesson, of course. I'm like, you know, I already knew this horse was uptight and tight and worried because of him. It was not a loose, relaxed horse. And so none of this was working well. And I just wanted this horse to relax. It was so apprehensive underneath of me. And he's walking around holding the dressage whip. So the horse is really worried about him. And I'm just trying to get a good warm up on this horse and just let it relax into a loose walk, which it won't do. And if I release the reins, the horse is tight here and hurrying up. It's expecting me to ask something. It's got my instructor who's spooking the hell out of this horse. It's not good. We come up to the mirror and he's like, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? And we, you know, I'm going around doing my thing. And finally we come up to the mirror and he's like, here. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready for what? I'm what do you want? What else? You know, we need to still warm up. And he's like, just gather up the reins and ask the horse for the pee off. And then he stood behind the horse and all he had to do was bring that whip up. And that horse was like you, this going through the movement, this tight, horrible movement. But if you don't know what it should feel like, and I did, then you think this is the way a pee off should feel, and that the horse should be this tense and this worried about getting hit. you know, I don't know what was going on. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. But that's what a lot of people in, you know, that's, these are high-class trainers in my area. You know, this is what a lot of people experience though. You've got to get educated and you've got to have that level of consciousness within yourself that seeks, that keeps asking questions. People always ask me, how do you know so much, Caroline? Because I'm always asking questions. I never stopped. If it didn't look right and it didn't feel right, I'm going to go to somebody else. And if I couldn't find it, then I would go to the great master's books, you know, whatever I could get my hands on that I could read. I could see illustrations. I could connect the dots. It made sense biomechanically. I became educated enough to know and then explore that with my own horses. So education, I just come back. People have to be open to asking questions and not being disrespectful to your instructor or your trainer, but maybe not say anything to their face, not being disrespectful. But if you don't understand it and it's not being explained well, or it doesn't feel right, then stop and go somewhere else. You can always come back, right? And go, hey, but I think people are just, it's a big lack of education.
Okay. But I have a big question for you because I'm still, humans are a mystery for me, right? And I'm learning, yeah. I'm getting better at it. I mean, I've been in trouble a lot for asking questions. Probably the tone of how I asked the question really was the problem, but you learn that later.
Me, right there. Me. Yes.
Right. So the question is, you know, I'm going another way with this. You know, I have awakened horsemanship, but I'm also going self seeds and I want to work with kids and do this. Right. So it's unbelievable what I'm learning about, you know, where we are in the development of youth asking questions. Right. So how do we, I feel like when I start a young horse, the biggest gift I can give that horse is to preserve its curiosity and its willingness. And then you stack on all the rest of it over time. But that, because to me, that's what creates safety, right? Okay.
Yes,
so let's come over here now to kids and adults that have trauma. And on and on, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you're dead on with what you're saying. But the question is, how do you manifest that? I mean, you build that trust with your clients and your kids that you're coaching or whoever, but they don't always come with it either, do they? And I'm learning through offering this program with only two-leggeds is that, boy, the two-leggeds in a herd, they come with very different willingness to engage, to ask questions, to be involved. And because like you, my background is horses, I've had the teachers kind of ask me, well, how did you get that one to talk? Or how did you, you know, do this? Well, I don't even know. But all I do is I try to stay present and inviting without judgment to kind of absorb and cheerlead the uniqueness and the try, right? I mean, when we talk about the training, the willingness, the try, not to disturb the try. And I wonder with kids, because
to encourage the try, right? You have to encourage it. There's a lot of horses and kids, humans, adults that are so traumatized, they don't know how to try. It's a trust factor. It's feeling safe in your environment. And that's what you're creating for the horse and the child, the person. Because I have a lot of adults that have, I work with mostly adults, not children. So if the adults have the trauma all these years, where's their try? Where's the horse's try too? So you're creating a safe space. I create a safe space. Actions speak louder than words. Kids, especially the young kids, they learn by watching and observing and associating. So as a leader, I'm all about exemplary leadership. And this is, you know, just if you, because I've worked with a lot of trauma with youth too. And that's the thing that's always worked for me and worked for me personally in my trauma is feeling safe. And that takes time and consistency. You got to show up the same all the time. You can't give mixed messages to horses or kids. It totally discourages their level of safety and feeling safe and trust. So you've got to build on those building blocks and you just, You pray, you manifest, you set the intention, and you hold that space because you can't force it. You have to do things that allow that opportunity, just like for the horse and in my training program. And it's the same for the people. I create an opportunity, whether I mix you with certain horses or I give you specific exercises that will help you get where you need to get, whatever that is, whatever that confidence, that trust, that try, that willingness, that openness to learning. For me, it's no different. I say all the time, people and horses are the same. You know, horses are so intelligent in so many ways. They get it. When they're open, they understand it. When they're open, they absorb like children. They absorb like a sponge. They're quick learners, like young horses that don't have damage. They're quick learners and they never forget anything like elephants. So, but we've got to get them to that place where they're not in their sympathetic nervous system, you know, and self-defense and self-preservation. Children. So yeah, so you, it's taking those ingredients as a teacher now, and I prefer to be called a teacher of horses and people, you know, taking those ingredients and putting them all together. And eventually it happens. Eventually the two-legged and the four-legged will open up. They're, you know, for me, they're, in my experience, I have found that formula. I have found the formula. It's easier for horses, much easier. You know, they don't have they just don't process and get stuck as much as we do. So horses, it's a lot easier to get them to open up and release and move forward. But there is a formula for people too, but they have to be willing. In the end, the layers of trauma and trust can be so deep and layered.
I see that with the horses though. That's one thing that's interesting for me in this, I'm going to call it my current science experiment, is to recognize the depth of trauma in the horses. I have a very dear friend I'm working with who's taking some of the horses. And there's a horse here named Gracie. She's I work with an animal communicator, and she has a scar on her ankle, and I don't know if it's from some of the Tennessee walking world. I'm learning about that, you know, the chains and things they do. And
the soaring.
She told the woman, no, I can't talk about it. I can't yet. So you realize, and then when my friend who's lovely, I mean, I've worked with her for, I don't know, 40 years now, it seems like, is that that horse just yelled at me, I'm not ready to leave. I need to heal more. And to look at her, she'd healed a lot already. And I literally, with whatever she was transmitting, because I wasn't hearing her. I mean, when I look back, I saw little dribbles of it, but I didn't hear it. I spent 3 hours feeling like I was going to vomit and just sobbing, feeling her anxiety and grief that she was going to have to leave before she healed. And I think about, I'm a fairly experienced, you know, sensitive horse trainer, but now this is taking me to another level and responsibility. And so, like you, it makes me circle back to wanting to work with the client in that way. But I think you have to have people, and please correct me if you have an answer for this, I'm all ears, is that if you have to have the type of client that's looking for these answers and questions.
Absolutely.
Because
absolutely,
I know when I'm teaching kids that are more in the, you know, patterning system, I can slip in lots of little things, you know, just how'd that feel, or what did you think about that, you know, asking them questions rather than drilling them and yelling at them. I mean, I've seen, probably like you, some pretty cruel riding lessons, but by inviting them to participate in how they think and feel and react and what did they learn, and hearing how they processed it and integrated it, it just completely. But I think that's what we do, hopefully, with the horse too, right? To see the outcome of it. It isn't to force it like you on that piaffing a horse in front of the mirror. You can force a lot of horses to do that, but it's terrifying because you also know that lots of things can go sideways in that moment. right? But then if a person is told by an authority, this is where, I mean, we could get all into that, right? What happens with the authority and the violation of, you know, youth or blah, blah. I mean, it's such a conundrum, isn't it? And really, one of the things I came away with from India was that I go, oh, I get it. It's not personal to the horse. It's the world. Just pick your design, whether it's dogs or children or women or on and on or racial. Just no. The horses are just caught in this messiness of our human evolution. But I always was like, can't they see it? Can't they feel it? And I was so angry about the human, how they couldn't see or resolve, or why were they like, you know, you, why are they doing that? Can't they see it?
It's levels of consciousness. No, it's levels. It's like Dr. David Hawkins, one of my favorite reads, the levels of consciousness. And I've talked about this before in podcasts, you know, and there are levels of consciousness with God and Gandhi being at the top, the divinity. But most of us, unfortunately, according to the science out there, and Dr. Hawkins is one of the leading experts on this, measuring the levels of consciousness. What do humans do as a species across the board that keeps them? They don't raise the consciousness. They don't want to learn. They don't get out of their comfort. They stay in their ego, and their ego controls them and keeps them, you know, existing on a certain level. But we got to get beyond that ego to get to where, what we're all talking about. And it's fear. It's fear. It's can be many things, but a lot of people are afraid to let go of what they know because it builds a sense of comfort, you know, and control and safety, but it's false and it's fake. And most people don't want to be vulnerable and to allow themselves to not know and to keep searching and also tuning into what feels right for us and tuning into other sentient beings like the horse and reading when is it right for the horse? When are we doing things that don't look right, that we can see it's not right for the horse and stopping that? You know, whether the horse understands and we just need to get an understanding, the horse is confused or the horse is triggered, you know, it's people just as a whole level of consciousness. And that you are right. I mean, the people that are, you know, of like mind that are interested in these podcasts that we're doing right now, they're of like mind. So we're all here together on this journey of searching and being better for ourselves and being better for our horses. No, we keep raising it. The consciousness keeps the spirituality there. You know, we keep raising that, but unfortunately the majority of the people aren't there. They're not seeking this, you know, they're happy where they are the same way.
The need will be there because of, we started out by talking about digital life now. And there's going to be an illness besides alcoholism and overeating and all of these things. It's going to be social media. And kids, you know, there's the whole be outside with your children and get off of the screen and all of this stuff. And where can you do that? With horses, right? You put your phone away. You hope you put your phone away. Otherwise, it comes out of your back pocket and ends up in the pasture, right? So what the hell?
Good point. Hope for humanity is my point, Susan.
No, but Lydia, what's great, we could do our own talk sometime. I would love, because one of the things that the horses have led me to is looking at the same harmony that I try to respect the horse with in the land. And I've thought about doing a program here where people have a lockbox. They come and they put their devices in the lockbox. And they just spend whatever their addiction allows, whether it's an hour, it's a half a day, 2 days, that they can be without their devices so they can remember who they are without a device. I mean, it's easier for people our age because we didn't have devices. So we're not nervous when we don't have them. Gosh, I'm actually looking at that as offering this facility And do people want that though? That's part of my question. Like, I want to hear you as you develop your amazing program, because you would think everybody would want it. But like you said, how does that work? The attraction and all of it. I wonder if I offer a program out here where people just come, put their devices in a lockbox and wander around drinking tea with horses and enjoying the sound of the wind. Yeah. And, you know, and just nature. Say, okay, this is what it is. The program, I'm not going to entertain you. I'm not doing anything. It's you just being and remembering. Right. But do yes. people want these things? Right. You try, I guess.
Yes.
Do we try?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, they do want it. They do want what we're offering. The biggest thing is getting out there and getting noticed. So, you know, setting up, unfortunately, social media, setting up YouTube, setting up Facebook, and getting out there and promoting yourself so that people are aware that these offerings are here. That's, yeah, it definitely, there's a huge, huge, look at all the magazines as a marketing person. Myself, you just look at all the different programs that come through my newsfeed, right? The algorithm. So if I'm into all this spiritual stuff, you're getting Gaia, you're getting all these neat, you know, join this workshop and learn this, you know, wellness or well-being practice. So it's all out there. You look at the magazines that are out there. This is a huge want and need. And even if it's from an older generation like ourselves, you know, most of us have children or grandchildren, so we still have an influence, and those children have our genes. So they have some level of desire for those to be one with nature, so to speak, including the horse. So it's out there. You just, as a newbie, you, Susan, coming into this, and as someone that's been in it, but still needs, you need the money to promote yourself. You need the advertising on Facebook and get your YouTube channel, which you have. Speaking of which, we're going to get ready to wrap this up. So I want everybody to know how they can find you. And will you talk a little bit about your program and where they can find you?
Well, it's almost ready, but it's called Awakened Horsemanship, and it's on my Selfseeds site in the program section. And I decided, I did a whole page that kind of tells you all about what the program is. And then there's a page that's actually, if you want to buy the program or you want to sign up for the newsletter, all those normal things. And so that's it. They can always email me. You know, I'm really good about answering emails. They can reach out to me on social media and all of it. You know, I just am excited. Like, you're like finding an oasis out there. That, oh my gosh, look, when, like you said, we were talking and it was like, where have you been my whole life? Right. You know, like how we
yeah, just exactly where have you been
that rabbit hole. It was so great. Right. And so you give me hope that there's others in that loop. And I guess for me, it's kind of a new alignment because I'd been doing competitive dressage and then I went to India. And now I'm sort of stumbling around finding my way again in what is it that I want to offer if people are interested. So thank you for asking that question. And it is a new design. So thank you for being a leader in that and for inviting me to come and share all this information. I mean, it's so fun.
It is fun. And this, and we can, you know, like some of my other guest speakers, like Lydia from Canada, we're going to do a third part three series next week. I mean, you and I can continue this. There's so much to talk about and just have an open conversation and free flowing, you know, about horsemanship and harmony and seeking that feel and just sharing what that feels like to us and how do we find it. And you know, I've got a program all about it. You're developing a program all about it. So we're out there, but people, not everybody knows we're out there. You know, it's YouTube's been my biggest free, by far my biggest resource for people finding me. Everybody finds me through YouTube. So they don't find me on Facebook, but Facebook is just another marketing tool. And when you're doing ads, like, you know, for your program, when it's ready, you know, releasing it, that's a great place to set your ads campaign up in Facebook.
I'm going to put a little punch in there for Caroline's program, because at the age of 12, I became an apprentice to become a falconer, right? And I went through the journey stages to become a master falconer with a really amazing person in Idaho. And Caroline has that structured system of the levels. So I felt like I was joining a master and I was an apprentice, and it felt comfortable because she had the care of the horse and all of the stuff in her courses at my access. I didn't have to go look for it once I trusted that one human being and how she treated her animals, right? So yeah, so that's kind of why I'm here.
Oh, it's great. And you know, I've kind of gotten to a point where with the awakened horsemanship, the idea is that it's the awakening of the horseman that really needs the help more than the horses. Horses are pretty good at being horses. So when we kind of look at it, I was a little nervous. Like, I don't want it to be like I'm trying to be some, you know, spiritual guru in the horse world. No, it's about, we need to wake up to go this next part of the design in harmony with the horse. And so really mine is so simple. It's just about self-awareness on a mind, body, and spirit level at an introductory level, so that people start to see how that alignment will help them in their pursuit of aligning with the horse and their life, really.
Beautiful.
Right?
Beautiful.
Do you teach a little dance with that too? Do you teach a little dance with that?
I do an exercise with the integration and the partnering that is it. But you know, I love that question, because people keep thinking, oh, do you teach meditation? Do you teach yoga? It's like, no, I'm going to be stubborn. I teach the awareness, and you decide then if you need it. Like, I offered self seed once to an ascended master in India, and it was a hoot for me, because he goes, oh, I guess I need to be more aware of my body. And it was like, wow, it's working even in that level, right? So it literally is like this tray of breadcrumbs or bird seed or something gentle, hors d'oeuvres, that you have this experience. So then you decide who and how you can pursue that, right? But you don't know until you look to know there is something that you want to develop more in your design. Because Beautiful. Then at some point, it may be a hub, and then all these specialists can seed into the actual seeds. But I don't want people to be afraid to look under the hood, basically, right?
Yes. Very good point. Beautiful.
Very well put.
Yes, very well put. Well, our time is up, my dear, but you just email me. I'd love to do a series with you, and we'll just continue our conversation. I love this. It's so stimulating to me and inspiring. And I said this when you and I met, Susan, and God, Lydia knows, and Janine knows, just getting into these deep, beautiful, spiritual, philosophical conversations. And it just opens Pandora's box. They never end, right? They never end.
And that's, and I think as a seeker, which all of us are seekers right here, that's also the joy, right? Is that we know at some level it doesn't end. So we can always stay open to what's more. I call this place the green womb. And what this has brought to me in living in this and stewarding in this resonance, right? And I've always loved the land, but I love the earth and the land now at a level I didn't even know was possible. So the growth, right, that comes from that, you know, I mean, my gosh, it's exciting. And that's what we're doing now. Thank you. And falconry, oh my gosh, that's another one, right? Gosh.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, so thank great.
You. Yay. Thank you.
Loved it.
All right. That was awesome. We're going to sign off, everybody. Bless everyone. Thank you, Susan. What a beautiful podcast. I can't wait to explore more with you. I look forward to many more.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And nice to meet you, Lydia. Wonderful. You.
You too.
All right.
Thank you, Lydia. All right, everybody. Bye. Until next time. Okay. Thank you.